Just don't call me sir. German subs were about to close the sea lanes, so Chan hopped a boat to a tiny island off the coast of Greece owned by his old friend Francis Turville Petre, the world-famous archaeologist, sexual adventurer, and, of late, wild-haired recluse. Francis made history when he was fresh out of Oxford by uncovering Galilee Man, one of the first Neanderthal skulls to be discovered outside of Europe. But Francis was soon spending more time partying than digging. One fellow archaeologist wrote home in disgust about the empty whiskey bottles that were tossed out of Francis's tent and the Arab boys who crawled into it. And when a bout of syphilis sent him to Germany for treatment, he decided to abandon the deserts of Palestine and switch his specialty to sexual ethnology. Der Fronny, as he was known, became such a legend in the Berlin boy bars that he inspired both the musical Cabaret, by way of Christopher Isherwood's Berlin Stories, and W. H. Auden's play The Fronny. Then, abruptly, Francis vanished. Word got around that he was in seclusion on a Greek island, sleeping till dark, wandering by night, and surviving on a diet of brandy and bread, fortified by a weekly cup of Bovril. By the time Chan arrived, in 1939, the once bright star of British archaeology looked like a shipwreck survivor. Long, straight red Indian hair framed a sad, sallow face so lined that it was impossible to guess its owner's age, Chan would recall. Below it, an emaciated body, always clothed in bright colours, stretched 6 feet down to an almost freakishly small pair of sandaled feet. But Fronny's mind was as keen as ever, and during their long moonlit hikes together, he shared the secret of how he beat the world to the Galilee skull. Early in his career, Francis realized that when it came to archaeological knowledge and geological mastery, it would take him decades before he could compete with senior scientists. He needed a shortcut, so he began hanging around the villages, sipping tea and trading chit-chat, soaking up scandals and dialects and ghost stories. Legends have long tendrils, Francis believed, that eventually twine back to solid earth. If kids believe a patch of woods is haunted, they may really have seen spooky shadows, which, with a little investigating, could turn out to be goat herds taking shelter for the night in a cliffside crevice with an invisible entrance and terrific campfire ventilation. A warm snug today could have been just as cozy in the Stone Age, which means that in a vast desert with thousands of caves, an afternoon spent listening to old wives' tales could help you eliminate false leads and point you straight to the find of a lifetime. Francis's nose for gossip eventually led him to some chatty Bedouin traders who tipped him off to the cave where the skull would be found. The companionship and conversation of a man like Francis did much to dispel my increasing sense of guilt, so that the report of the evacuation from Dunkirk and the account of the Battle of Britain caused me no more than a passing twinge of conscience, recalled Chan, who wasn't gay but regarded Francis as one of the most stimulating and rewarding companions he had ever known. Chan spent his days painting landscapes and practicing Greek with Fonny's sick servants, waiting for his night stalker host to awake at dusk. Together they'd huddle around the radio and listen to evening war news from the BBC. Shouldn't we be ashamed? Chan wondered. Maybe it's time to do our duty. Francis snorted. What good do you think you could possibly be? Hitler took the choice out of their hands. Chan and Fronny got off the island ahead of the German invasion and reluctantly went their separate ways. Fronny opted for Egypt. He had a taste for erotic adventure, and wartime Cairo was sizzling with sexual intrigue. Fronny soon reclaimed his throne as master of back-alley revels, but collapsed within a few months. By age 40, bored with love, with sex, with travel, with friendship, even with food, as one friend recalled, The man who'd inspired Chan with his genius for learning secrets from the past was dead. Chan returned to Cyprus, where he found an even better way to hide from the war. He joined the army. Chan got a commission as a junior officer in the 1st Cyprus Battalion, the biggest joke in the Mediterranean theatre. The Cypriots had never had a military tradition, and it soon became clear that they were not going to break a habit formed before the 1st century by taking kindly to soldiering in the 20th, he observed. Many of Chan's fellow officers were disciplinary problems, who'd been chucked out of other details, or pacifists and shirkers desperate to avoid action. Our unit, then, was understandably free from any sense of regimental pride. Since neither officers nor enlisted men had any interest in engaging one another, let alone the enemy, they agreed to stay out of one another's way. The troops spent their time in Nicosia's brothels, while the officers lingered in the casinos. Within a few weeks, new recruits were less combat-ready than the day they arrived. The incidence of venereal disease among the men rose to a height that was only surpassed by the officers' drunkenness, Chan admitted. Chan's official assignment was to visit fake platoons. The Cypriots figured their best defense was trickery, so they built a bunch of phony barracks to make it appear as if the island were jammed with troops. All those phantom units, Chan would recall, were represented only by myself. He roared around all day on a motorcycle, delivering messages to these invisible brigades in the hope that, somehow, Hitler would believe Cyprus was too heavily fortified to attack. What a delightful surprise war turned out to be. Military service on Cyprus, Chan would later acknowledge, was one of the most carefree periods of my life. Until refugees from Crete began to arrive. The island was expected to surrender in a day, Chan noted. But when it didn't, when reports came through of shepherds and farm wives and village priests defending their island with barn tools and rabbit guns and, in one case, an old man's walking stick, when these peasants and a battered rank of British troops somehow held off Germany's fiercest fighters until the sun had set on Hitler's deadline and rose again on another day, Chan began feeling a strange sensation. Envy. I felt that if I had to fight, the least ignoble purpose and the most personally satisfying method would be the purpose and method of the Cretans, he'd recall. The Cretans weren't taking orders and wearing uniforms. They were thinking and fighting for themselves, using their own skill and ingenuity and natural weapons to defend their homes and families. No one had to train them or tell them what to do. Their own traditions had prepared them all their lives for this moment. My own position as a member of an organized army, Chan recalled, became increasingly galling. Chan began haunting the Cyprus waterfront, greeting refugees from Crete as soon as they arrived, so he could get first-hand news about the resistance. Word of his interest must have spread, because one morning a stranger came looking for him. He gave Chan directions to a building in Cairo and said if he was serious about Crete, he should go to Egypt at once. Chan would find out more, maybe, once he got there. Soon, Chan was touching down in Cairo and hailing a taxi.
Ah, the driver responded when Chan gave him the address. You mean the secret house?
The firm might be invisible to the rest of the world, but not to Cairo cabbies. Whatever the organization was up to, it was attracting so many mysterious visitors that the cab ranks had marked the address as an eerie but profitable fare. Chan found the building and was shown into a back room. There he met Jack Smith Hughes, who was already in charge of finding recruits for the firm to send to Crete.
Have you any personal objection to murder? Jack began.
Chan had to admit the only time he had come close to acting like a hero, the only time he'd come close to a fight, was when he tried to stop a gang of drunk Australians from bullying a Jewish family. One of the Aussies grabbed him by the jacket and yanked him off his feet, snarling,
"Whose side are you on, Galahad?"
That did it for Chan's chivalry. To be honest, Jack was okay with that. The army didn't make him a hero. The army made him a baker. It was only when Jack was abandoned, when he was on the run and in the hands of the Cretans, that he turned into a force to be reckoned with. And that gave Jack an idea. In Scotland, Fairbairn and Sykes were trying to reconstruct the art of the hero and pass it along to their students. But on Crete, Chan could skip the middlemen and learn the same ancient skills directly from the source. If Chan put himself in the hands of Beowulf and that canny young shepherd, George Sikundakis, maybe he would learn more in action than he would at any school. He'd get pancration from the source. He'd discover how shepherds climbed mountains all night on a starvation diet, and learn instinctive shooting from shepherds and bandits who could split a man's skull from a quarter mile away without any sights on the rifle. Jack knew it could be done, because one man had already done it. John Pendlebury was a British archaeologist who'd come to Crete well before the war. Pendlebury was missing an eye, had never served in the military, and was nearly twice Chan's age. So, of course, he had to get off the island as soon as Hitler pivoted toward the Mediterranean. Except Pendlebury stayed put.
It required more resolution in an Englishman to stay behind voluntarily and be submerged by the German tide than to return later, reflected Nicholas Hammond, a Cambridge archaeologist and one of Pendlebury's friends. But for John, the choice did not exist.
Before long, the Oxford academic had been transformed into a legend whose name would send Hitler into a rage. That's because strange things can happen on that island, Jack discovered. Fierce, audacious, brilliant things that no one should be expected to pull off, least of all a baker and a one-eyed archaeologist. That tiny rock in the sea had made Hitler bleed, and it changed the Third Reich's military strategy forever. Never again would the hunters from the sky lead an invasion.
Crete has always been a theatre for strange and splendid events,
Paddy would later agree, marvelling at Crete's
indestructible old men and their extremely handsome sons, the way their eyes kindle and their grins widen at the suggestion of any rash scheme. Especially, he added, if the scheme involves danger.
2 weeks later, Chan poked his head out of a submarine hatch and into a howling gale. He tried to speak, but nothing came out.
The shriek of the wind, he realized, drowned every other sound.
Waves smashed against the side of the sub, shattering and sinking a collapsible canoe, the canoe Chan was supposed to be in. Instead of 4 months of round-the-clock training at SOE school, Chan had spent 3 days blowing up abandoned trains.
The knowledge that no railway existed in Crete did not dampen my immediate ardour for demolition work, he'd comment. Those daily explosions in the sand represented all the training I received before being recalled to Cairo a few days after Christmas.
As soon as Chan got back from his bomb-blasting holiday, he was told to pack a duffel and get to the waterfront. First they set off toward Crete in a camouflaged navy trawler, but twice fierce seas forced them to turn around and return to Egypt. Finally, sub-commander Anthony Crap Myers offered to bring them in beneath the waves. They got within sight of the island, but just as they launched the first man in his canoe, a storm blew in and swirled him off into the darkness. After that, nothing. For half an hour they scanned the churn, hoping for a sign he was still alive and afloat. Crap couldn't linger any longer.
Bad business, he finally said. Your man is either dead, adrift, or surrounded by
A pinprick of light flashed. Good old Guy. He and his canoe had made it. Guy Delaney was an Australian staff sergeant in his 50s, with bushy eyebrows and bristling whiskers. A survivor of the Falsheim Jaeger invasion who, like Jack Smith Hughes, had managed to hide for months in the mountains and escape by way of the Preveli Monastery. If a battered piece of army surplus like Guy Delaney could survive that surf, Chan figured, so could he. The sailors quickly readied another canoe, but the waves crushed it, then the next one. Chan and his partner had one last chance of making it to shore, Crap told them. A rubber raft would swamp if they sat inside. But they might be able to straddle it like a rodeo bronco, clutching it between their thighs as they thrash like hell with their paddles. Three sailors fought to hold the raft as it lunged alongside the sub like a grey monster fish cavorting in and out of the surf, as Chan put it. Not courage, I think, but fear prompted the decision, Chan continued. He dreaded the thought of cramming himself back inside the stifling sub. He threw himself onto the raft, followed by a man he'd recently met and already hated. Captain Guy Terral was even older than Delaney. He was a World War I vet who'd spent the years since then pip-pipping around the British tropics in a pith helmet. Terral was driving Chan nuts, trying to speak to Greek crewmen in his colonial Francais and constantly repeating, "You see, I've lived so long in the bush," and offering advice that was more applicable to a peacetime safari than a clandestine naval operation. True to form, Terral had shown up for the undercover mission with a pack stuffed with pyjamas and an enamel wash basin. He was also in full military uniform and his pith helmet, which Chan chucked overboard as soon as Terral wasn't looking. The sailors released the rope, and the current sucked the raft away and began spinning it in circles. And at that moment, as the raft twirled, like a buoyant saucer trapped in a whirlpool, Chan and Terral achieved a kind of perfection. The two novice secret agents were the perfect expression of everything that Churchill's generals told him was foolish about his plan. This was going to stop Hitler? Captain Raito splashing around the Mediterranean with some smart-ass slacker? An obnoxious little artist whose first order of business as a member of an ultra-secret force behind enemy lines was to prank the only man who could cover his back? Face it, Terral might be handy with explosives and had a drawerful of dusty medals, but how was he going to infiltrate hostile territory when he kept forgetting that in Greece they don't speak French? Chan and Terral chopped at the water with their paddles and finally managed to stop spinning. Crap sub submerged behind them and disappeared, leaving them adrift on a squishy raft in a sea as dark as the sky. Guy Delaney, bless his bristly Aussie mug, was still flicking his flashlight on the beach. Chan and Terral spotted him through the waves and began digging toward shore. For half an hour they paddled through the surf, slowly getting closer to Delaney's light, until suddenly it went black. Was that a pistol shot they heard? A shout? Impossible to tell. Chan and Terral waited, floating. But the light never reappeared. With no other choice, they pushed on toward the beach. Chapter 14. We will take our arms and flee to the White Mountains. John Pendlebury. In a last letter to his wife before the German invasion. Chan's boots scraped pebbly sand, then a wave cracked and sent him tumbling. He stumbled to his feet, and together with Terral, he struggled through the surf and up onto the beach. There was no sign of Guy Delaney.
"Something must have gone wrong," Terral said.
"But he signaled okay."
"That doesn't mean a thing. The Germans may have intentionally let him make his signal before nabbing him, in the hope of nabbing us as well."
Chan knew Terral was right. Their original plan was to come ashore a few miles away and rendezvous with another British agent in a hidden cove. But rough seas had forced them farther down the coast. More than likely, they'd landed near a German lookout, which meant Guy was a goner. Delaney would be lucky if the Germans didn't open fire the instant they spotted his light, thanks to that whole Operation Flipper fiasco. A few weeks earlier, A British commando assault team using the same rubber rafts as Chan and Taral and launching from the same sub came ashore on another Mediterranean beachfront, this one in Libya. They were hunting Erwin Rommel, the Desert Fox, whose unstoppable Africa Corps panzers were threatening to overrun Cairo. The Brits burst through Rommel's bedroom door with grenades flying and guns blazing. Except Rommel, famous for his Fingerspitzengefühl, fingertip feel, or sixth sense, had already moved base. But the fact that Allied raiders got within pistol range of a top general's bed, even an empty one, left a lasting impression of what to expect from strangers in the night in rubber rafts. The storm, that's what must have saved Chan and Chiral. They must have blown past the sentries, who couldn't spot their grey raft in the dark chop. They had to get to cover, fast, but where do you run when you don't know where anyone is? Chan saw a faint strip of light in the distance.
Let's crawl in for a look, Taral urged.
It was risky, but shrewd. They could at least figure out where not to go, and hopefully confirm Guy's whereabouts. Chan pulled his pistol and slipped off the safety.
I started creeping up the beach towards the light, which, as I approached, revealed itself as a gap in a shuttered window.
Chan inched closer and picked up a snatch of conversation. He listened intently, then got to his feet.
Be ready to give me covering fire, he whispered to Taral. I'm going in.
Before Taral could grab him, Chan charged.
I kicked open the door, at the same time flourishing my pistol and flashing on my torch. And there, sitting by a twig fire in steaming long-legged underwear, was Guy Delaney, drying his clothes and chatting with the fisherman who owned the hut.
You've been bloody slow getting here, Delaney grumbled.
Chan had recognized Delaney's voice and understood the fisherman's Greek, so he'd only mock-attacked to get Taral's goat. Delaney was just as relieved. He'd been chilled to the bone on the beach and finally had to get warm or risk hypothermia. Even the fisherman was delighted. He wanted to call the whole village to arms and was just a bit crestfallen when Chan explained that the three midnight guests were alone and not the advance team of a full Allied invasion. Only Taral was in a foul mood. He'd been through too much in his life, not to mention that night alone, to tolerate any more of Chan's shit. But the fisherman had a little gift to cheer him up. A prisoner.
There's a German here in Sutsuros.
A deserter had turned up a few days ago and kept hanging around, hoping to find someone he could surrender to. He couldn't have wandered into better luck. That little cove was too barren and inaccessible for the Germans to bother with. So Chan and his team were the only outsiders anyone had seen for weeks. Crap was supposed to surface again the following night to offload rifles for the Cretans and supplies for the British agents, so Taral could paddle the forlorn German out to the sub and notch himself a catcher. By the time Chan dried and warmed himself, dawn was breaking. He'd only seen Crete through the sub's periscope, so as the sun rose, he went outside for his first good look. You'd expect to be dazzled by sea views on a skinny sausage of an island like that, 161 miles long and 37 wide at its thickest, 12 at its thinnest. But even those turquoise shimmers are overshadowed by the startling explosion of mountains. From the beach, it all looks so easy, so summery, alpine and inviting. It's only when you push into the hills and find yourself twisting through gorges and smacking into sheer rock faces hidden by trees that you discover why there was no coast-to-coast road and why a 2-mile trek could take 4 hours and leave you where you started. No wonder Crap's sub was able to come within a mile of the beach without being spotted. All that elevation meant Chan was nicely hidden by a giant stone fence. Most of Crete's mountains run right through the middle of the island, creating a jagged belt separating the Germans in the north from the rebels in the south. Just east of Chan, ablaze in the early morning sun, was the skyscraping prenatal unit of the world's first guerrilla fighter, Zeus, greatest of the Greek gods. Zeus wasn't born to the throne. He scrapped his way there, Cretan style. Zeus's father was Cronos, the titan who ruled the earth and swallowed his children so they wouldn't overthrow him. When Cronos's wife was pregnant with Zeus, she snuck away to Cicro Cave in Crete's easternmost Dicte Mountains. After giving birth, she returned home and fooled Cronos into swallowing a stone wrapped in a baby's blanket, while the infant, safe in Crete, strong of limb and crafty, was raised by Dictina, the cunning and elusive goat nymph. A tribe of mountain warriors, the Curites, guarded the baby and performed a shield-clanging war dance so Cronos wouldn't hear him crying. When Zeus was big enough, he cut his brothers and sisters free from dad's belly and led them in bringing down the tyrant. Some insist Zeus's birth cave was farther west of Chan on Mount Ida, Crete's highest peak, which made a lot of sense. Ida is snow-crowned and glorious, home to golden eagles and the Cricri, the rare and magnificent Cretan ibex. Sure enough, searchers located a palatial cave on Ida overlooking the Amari, Crete's luscious valley. Buried inside this natural throne room were ancient offerings, bracelets, Egyptian pottery, bronze knives. Pythagoras was even said to have made a pilgrimage to the Idaean cave, and Euripides mentioned Idaean Zeus in his play The Cretans. The Idaean cave is majestic enough for a king, but the infant Zeus was a fugitive with a death sentence. That's one reason why, in 1901, the British archaeologist D.G. Hobarth decided to take another look at Cicro. The Dicte Range is dark and rough, exactly the kind of place where a wild child could disappear from the world and be raised by a band of loyal mountain men and a mystical she-goat. Hobarth pushed deep into the rocked-off recesses of Cicro. Blasting his way with dynamite into an abysmal chasm, he discovered a treasury of other devotional gifts, including Cretan double axes, believed to be a sacred emblem of Zeus. Far more than the trinkets discovered in the Idaean cave, but more important, far older. The cave of Ida, however rich it proved in offerings when explored some years ago, has no sanctuary approaching the mystery of this, Hobarth wrote. Visitors assumed regal Mount Ida was the place for a god, but true Cretans knew the Dicte is where a hunted man would hide. The killers were coming for Chan too. German troops may have spotted the sub and could already be closing in, so the longer he lingered in Sutsuros, the more he risked himself and everyone in the village. He now had to search for Monty Woodhouse, the other British agent stationed on the island. Luckily, the solution soon appeared, high on a ridge behind him. Trotting down the rock slope came two Cretan Highlanders, both dressed in black shirts and old-time shepherd's breeches, with a knee-length crotch for easy running. The Highlanders hurried into Sutsuros with news. They could lead Chan to Monty, but they had to leave at once. Chan had been on the move for nearly 2 full days by that point, and eaten little more than bread crusts. But rested or exhausted, fed or famished, go time for a gorilla is non-negotiable. Chan set off behind one of the Highlanders and got his first taste of the Cretan bounce. As soon as we reached the foothills and started climbing, he was in his element at once, Chan noted, bounding from stone to stone with a speed and precision which defied our breathless attempts to emulate him. Monty's man was patient but relentless, slowing his uphill rock-hopping long enough to keep Chan in sight, but pushing steadily through the afternoon and into the evening. Finally, at nightfall, Chan trudged out of the mountains and into a bizarre dream world. Through the open door of the village coffee shop, I saw a horde of frenzied giants in tattered khaki and slouch hats, he observed. The chorus of Waltzing Matilda filled the dusk. More than a dozen drunk Australian soldiers were sloshing about, guzzling Cretan moonshine. After months on the run, The fugitive Aussies had heard that Krat was on the way and came out of hiding to slip down to the beach. When they discovered Krat had come and gone without them, their determination to remain invisible gave way to desperate drinking. For one night, at least. Chan slunk past, head down.
"The sight of them reminded me of the last time I had to deal with drunken Australians," he'd remark,
recalling his quick surrender when he tried to defend a Jewish family from some Aussie bullies. Chan was led to a small house and entered to find his boss, a 24-year-old Oxford Classics scholar who not only looked like a college boy on spring break, but not long ago was. Montgomery Woodhouse was tall and gawky, so blonde and pink-cheeked in that roomful of ferocious stubble that he almost looked albino. Still, Monty had style. Chan had to admire the superb shepherd's cloak Monty had chosen for his disguise.
"Clandestine life came easily enough to me," Monty would explain. "My Greek was good enough to deceive the enemy, though my appearance was against me. Of course, no Greek was ever deceived either by my accent or my disguise, but that was an asset, because as soon as I was recognized, a spontaneous conspiracy sprang up to protect me."
7 weeks behind enemy lines had also hard sharpened him, so Monty got straight down to business. "Hitler suspects Crete is his Achilles heel," Monty explained. Chan's job was to convince him. Only 4,000 or 5,000 troops should be necessary to secure an island of Crete size, but the resistance had done such a superb job of making Hitler nervous that more than 80,000 Germans were still stationed there. Hitler desperately needed that manpower in North Africa and the Russian front, but he couldn't risk shifting them if it meant that an underground army would overthrow his Mediterranean base.
"Which makes you," Monty told Chan, "the master of mayhem in the middle."
Clans and villages across the island had turned themselves into small guerrilla forces, each under the leadership of its own chieftain. And every Cretan who wasn't carrying a gun was still armed with eyes and ears. No German plane could leave the island without being spotted, and no German soldiers could board a troop ship without being counted. Chan would be the spider in the center of the web. He'd have to race back and forth across the island, bringing in weapons by parachute for Cretan bandits, and radioing German plane coordinates for British fighter pilots. Every day that Chan could stay alive, Monty told him, was another day that Field Marshal Rommel's panzers might have to wait for fuel, Russian fighters could hold out in Leningrad, and entire German regiments would be lost in the Cretan mountains in pursuit of a few dozen invisible men. But for now, Chan would have to do it alone. Monty was heading back to the mainland, so Chan would basically be on his own until a new man could be recruited. And his first challenge, Monty warned, could be his last. Chan's only contact with the outside world would be his radio operator, who was in a hideout on Mount Ida. Between them lay some of the most treacherous terrain on the island, the Massara Valley, which led right to the Germans' main airbase. To establish radio contact with Cairo, Chan would have to trek across 100-some miles of mountain and slip through crisscrossing German patrols. If he could do that, then it was on to even trickier territory, the White Mountains, a favorite lair for bandits, rebels, and John Devitt's stringfellow Pendlebury, the one-eyed archaeologist who'd become one of the great enigmas of the war. No one on Crete was more hated by the Germans or more hunted. Stories had spread beyond the island of Pendlebury's thugs, a band of allied evaders led by a tall, pale man with a patch over one eye and a silver dagger in the sash around his waist.
"The small force of British, New Zealand and Australian troops who evaded capture in Crete and are conducting vigorous guerrilla warfare against the Germans," Reuters news agency reported, "are commanded by a British officer well known to the islanders." In broadcast from Berlin, the German military fumed. "It is undoubtedly to be attributed to Pendlebury's activities
that large numbers of the population turn guerrilla.
The thugs were said to fight like desperados, sniping from the dark with deadly aim, taking no prisoners. If Pendlebury's exploits were real, Churchill and those two old Shanghai hands, Fairbairn and Sykes, would be delighted. It meant at least one swashbuckling Brit had come up with a way to give Hitler a taste of total war. The Führer was reportedly so intent on seeing Pendlebury killed that he demanded the glass eye be plucked from Pendlebury's skull and sent to him as a war prize. Greek prisoners were forced to search through piles of corpses, poking their fingers into eye sockets. But as of Chan's arrival on Crete in December, Pendlebury's whereabouts were still unknown. Monty finished his briefing. Chan was desperately tired and needed a solid meal and a good rest before making his attempt on Mount Ida. On the other hand, there were those Australians.
"Since I felt no particular urge to remain in Akendria," he judged, "I decided to set off at once."
Chapter 15. The friend of wisdom is also a friend of the myth. Aristotle. Horrible idea.
"Had we known what was to come," Chan complained, brushing by the fact that he'd been warned exactly what was to come, "we would never have started out immediately after two consecutive days with little rest or food."
Still, maybe Monty could have been more specific about the weather. Chan and Delaney hadn't gotten far from Akendria when it started to rain, building to a downpour that continued all night. Finally, after hours of stumbling in the dark on wet stones and pulling his boots out of gluey mud, Chan gave up. If he was caught, so be it.
Even the threat of capture and its inevitable outcome, the firing squad, were not sufficient to induce us to keep walking, he'd recall. I found myself longing for the sudden appearance of a German patrol to put an end to our increasingly unbearable muscular fatigue and sleeplessness.
That did it for Costa too. As Chan's guide, he'd done his best to live up to Xenia, the Cretan code of hospitality. Xenia speaks to the heart of Greek identity, because every Greek at some point has been a stranger. In ancient Greek, stranger and guest are even the same word. In a nation of seafarers and shepherds and traveling scholars, of earthquakes and warfare and overseas trade, relying on an occasional unexpected handout is necessary and inevitable. All is performed with simplicity and lack of fuss, and prompted by kindness so unfeigned, one British traveller still marvelled after many trips to Greece, that it invests even the most ramshackle hut with magnificence and style.
Xenia isn't even a virtue, really. It's a law enforced by thunder god Zeus himself. Much the way Christianity adopted a pay-it-forward policy as its greatest commandment, and reveres a homeless savior who got by on handouts, the Olympian myths are all about the immortals quality-controlling Xenia by wandering about in human form and seeing how they're treated when they show up in disguise. The Iliad and the Odyssey, the two Greek pillars of Western literature, are Xenia written in blood, a pair of epic thrillers that explore what happens when you A. abuse hospitality by monkeying with your host's wife and B. depend on it during a 20-year road trip to hell and back. A Cretan is measured by her Xenia, and the three rules are very clear. You offer food, you offer a bath, you ask no questions. Not, at least, until the traveller has been refreshed. That way, he'll at least get a bite and a breather in case you discover you can't stand him. You can think of Xenia as compassion, but only if you get rid of the notion that compassion is based on sweetness or charity or even trading favours. Compassion is a battle instinct, a jungle law alert system that lets you know when someone or something is closing in on you for the kill. We like to pretty it up with a halo and call it angelic,
that compassion really springs from our raw animal need to figure out what is going on around us and the smartest way to respond. It's your social spider web, a protective netting of highly sensitive strands that connects you to your kinfolk and alerts you the instant one of them runs into the kind of trouble that can find its way back to you. Compassion requires you to be a wonderful listener, much like psychiatrists and FBI profilers, and for essentially the same reason. The goal is to get inside someone else's head. And in that regard, rule number 3 of Xenia was way ahead of both crime detection and psychoanalysis. Peppering someone with questions, as any police interrogator will tell you, isn't nearly as effective as letting him relax until the words flow on their own. And when they do, when you get access to someone else's feelings, you can put aside your own and see the world through a new set of eyes. That kind of insight is crucial to what combat soldiers call situational awareness, a constant mental scan of your environment so you're always up to the second on the best and worst way out of any situation. That's really the unvarnished essence of Xenia, and it's the reason Darwin and Andrew Carnegie could never quite grasp what heroes are all about. They thought it was crazy to risk yourself for a stranger. But to someone truly tuned into situational awareness, into Xenia, treating a stranger like a brother can be the only sane response. Many years after the war, Americans rushed to their televisions to watch Xenia in action when Air Florida Flight 90 crashed into the icy Potomac River on January 13, 1982. To horrified viewers, it seemed impossible that anyone could be alive inside the mangled steel carcass slowly vanishing into the water. But one by one, 6 survivors gasped to the surface and grabbed at the tail of the plane. Freezing rain and winds were so brutal, it took 20 minutes before a rescue chopper finally arrived. It dropped a life ring into the hands of one survivor and plucked him from the water. Then something peculiar happened. The next person to receive the ring handed it over to someone else. The chopper lofted her to safety, then wheeled back. The man gave away the ring again, and again. He even gave it away when he knew it was his last chance to live. He must have known because when the chopper thundered back seconds later, he was gone. The man in the water had vanished beneath the ice. He was later identified as Arland Chubb Williams Jr., a 46-year-old federal bank examiner who hated water and spent his life, until the day he lost it, playing it safe. Arland never called a lot of attention to himself, says Peggy Fusting, his high school sweetheart from Illinois, whom he'd begun dating again shortly before the crash. He'd had that fear of water his whole life. Arland was trusted by bankers and borrowers alike, his boss would say, because he was careful and discreet and never took risks. But there was another side of Arland, one that was formed nearly a quarter century earlier when he was a cadet at one of the country's most demanding military colleges, the Citadel. "They make a man out of you," I was told by Benjamin Franklin Webster, Arland's Citadel roommate. "The job of the upperclassmen is to remake you from a boy to a man in 1 year. They push you physically and mentally. We lost 30 cadets before we even started classes." When Webster heard about the crash, he was perhaps the only person who wasn't surprised that a risk-averse accountant would suddenly emerge as the hero of Flight 90. The Citadel has one iron law. "Always take care of your people first," Webster says. "That's an unbreakable code. You go last. Your people go first." Some of the survivors said Arland seemed to be trapped by the wreckage and unable to free himself, but instead of clinging desperately to the life ring or clawing out for help, he assessed the situation and realized there was only one best decision. To Arland, the survivors around him in the water weren't competitors in a battle for survival. They were family.
"Of course they were," agrees Lee Dugatkin, PhD,
a professor of biology at the University of Louisville who specializes in altruistic behavior. After all, xenia is the military specialty. For most of our evolutionary history, our ancestors moved in such tight family circles that the only people they'd ever see were members of their own hunter-gatherer clan.
If you save someone's life under those conditions, you are very likely saving a blood relative, he says.
But now our relatives are scattered all over the place, so the military has made a science out of reviving that lost feeling of fellowship.
The armed forces always use the language of kinship to condition soldiers to think of one another as family,
Dugatkin points out.
They're not strangers, they're a band of brothers.
Consider what happens when a bus full of strangers of all races and backgrounds pulls into Fort Benning for boot camp. As soon as you arrive, your head is shaved, your clothes are replaced with a uniform, you're taught to walk and talk and eat and make your bed exactly the same way as everyone around you. Because the more alike you look, the army understands, the more likely you'll look out for one another. Lawrence of Arabia underwent the same transformation during his first trip abroad as a young archaeologist. He arrived in Egypt as a fussy Brit and made one crucial decision that would change his life. Instead of spending his nights in the English compound, he began camping at the dig site with the Arab workers. He shared their meals of sour goat's milk and warm hearth bread. He traded his khakis for a tunic and a Kurdish belt and joined the singing and storytelling around the fire. Mostly he listened, absorbing the intricacies of their tribal and family jealousies, rivalries and taboos, their loves and hates, and their strengths and weaknesses. As one biographer would put it, when the Arab revolt began, Lawrence's xenia knew exactly where he had to be. He saw himself in them, and them in him. So when Chan and Delaney began lagging, Costa remained true to the xenia code. For as long as he could. He slowed his pace and carried their supplies, and he even bit his tongue when Chan weirdly insisted on bolting out of Akendria the same day they got there. But take a bullet for them? Forget it. Xenia says you have to be hospitable. It doesn't say you have to be an idiot. When the young Brit and the aging Aussie sergeant sank down and refused to get up, Costa tore into them. Delaney and I would have willingly succumbed, but for Costa's example and exhortation, Chan would admit. The relentless Costa dragged his two charges to their feet and got them moving again. By dawn, he'd harried them as far as the southern foothills of Mount Ida. There, at last, they could hole up in a little village and get some rest before pushing on that night. Except, something didn't feel right. Something about the valley was making Costa uneasy. It just seemed wrong. He hunted up a local and discovered his suspicions were correct. Germans were ransacking the villages in search of a local guerrilla. Costa had to get Chan and Delaney out of sight before the sun came up, so he led them into the cliffs and found a snug spot between some brush-covered rocks. They burrowed in while Costa slipped off for provisions, soon returning with goatskins of wine, a pot of cold beans, and some friends in the resistance. By the time he got back, Chan was already out cold. While the other men ate and whispered, Chan slept through the day on the cold, wet stone, too exhausted to eat. Turning himself into John Pendlebury was turning out to be a lot tougher than Chan had expected. Of course, Pendlebury had an advantage. He'd been practicing the art of becoming John Pendlebury his entire life. When Pendlebury was 2 years old, his parents left him one evening in the care of friends. When they returned, one of his eyeballs was punctured. Maybe the boy poked himself with a pen. Maybe he was scratched by a thorn. No one saw it happen or could ever figure it out, not even his father, a surgical professor and house surgeon at St. George's Hospital. Pendlebury didn't seem to mind at all. He liked to dress up the glass replacement with a monocle or pluck it out when going on a hike and leave it behind on his desk as a way of saying he'd be gone a while. His taste for masquerade followed him to Cambridge, where he became an excellent high jumper, despite poncing around between jumps in a white cloak. Although he was the university's preeminent archaeology student, Pendlebury liked to play the buffoon, according to a friend's recollection. He'd scrawl endless doodles of knights in armour in his notebooks, and he founded a drinking club he called Ye Joyous Company of St. Paul, a sort of boozing fantasy league for make-believe merry men. He and Lawrence of Arabia loved the same favourite book, which is an even odder coincidence because it's so awful. The Life and Death of Richard Yea and Nay is the story of Richard the Lionheart, except told with more stabbings, straining bosoms, and wild-eyed killers than a Mexican telenovela. Lawrence read it 9 times before he graduated Oxford, while Pendlebury was always raving about it to his friends. When a classmate dropped by before returning to Australia, Pendlebury pounced on his Richard Yea and Nay by Maurice Hewlett, which he gave me with instructions to think of him when I read it. This was a much bigger gesture than it appeared, for this grubby little book was, to John, a symbol of heroism and romance. Wrong. That's what his friends didn't get. To Pendlebury, those mace and maiden tales weren't symbols. They were real voices from the past, with important lessons to teach. Chivalry and the art of the hero were the fading lights of a train he just missed, and Pendlebury was obsessed with finding a way to catch up. Yea and Nay was his inspiration, and soon after he graduated Cambridge, he found his path. Pendlebury spent his 24th birthday as a visiting student at the British School in Athens, and it was there that a strange book with a blue and gold cover came into his hands. The Palace of Minos. Inside, he found a thrilling proposition. Was he willing to believe that all those myths he'd loved as a boy, King Minos and the Minotaur, Theseus and Ariadne, the Iliad and the Odyssey, were based on real people, real places, real events? Could he accept that they weren't just make-believe, but a snarled thread of history that, once untangled, led back to a time when heroes roamed the earth? Because if he could, fantastic new discoveries awaited him. And they began on the island of Crete. Pendlebury was so electrified, he left Athens within days of reading The Palace of Minos and went in search of its author, Arthur Evans, the eccentric adventurer and antiquities collector. Evans claimed he'd found hard proof that the legend of King Minos, son of Zeus, stepfather of the monstrous half-man, half-bull who ate 14 of Athens' best-looking teenagers every year, was based on a true story. Evans said he'd located not only Minos's lost kingdom and the Minotaur's fable labyrinth, but also the remains of a fabulous Minoan culture that dominated the Mediterranean 2,000 years before the pyramids were built. Was it a hoax? If so, Evans was going all out. To believe his story, you had to believe he found the birthplace of, well, everything. This lost world he described was so old, it was already dying by the time the Egyptians began making words out of dog and bird drawings. Science, literature, politics, advanced math, philosophy, sports, theatre, according to Evans, it all sprang from Crete, that craggy little cinder in the sea. It also meant that this near-sighted amateur, a fiery, squinting little man who strode about London smacking carriages with a hiking staff he called Prodger and set entire teams of diggers to work because he'd caught a whiff of fennel, had stumbled across a new chapter of human history nearly as long as the span from the birth of Julius Caesar to the death of Steve Jobs. Pendlebury's excitement grew as he got off the boat in Crete. Just walking along the waterfront was like seeing Evans's book come to life. In the frescoes Evans described, Minoan women were curiously graceful and attractive,
gaily dressed in the height of fashion, with elegantly coiffured hair, engaged apparently in gay chit-chat, as Evans put it, while Minoan men had the sinewy physiques of aerial acrobats.
They were quite unlike the classical Greeks, unlike the Egyptians, unlike the Babylonians, unlike any ancient people whose painted or sculpted representations had survived from the ancient past,
archaeological researcher Leonard Cottrell would note. There's something very right, Evans reflected, about a culture that betrays itself with such sass and strength. And here they were, alive and well, and strolling the streets.
I know of no sight finer than a well-dressed Cretan peasant, and with the dress goes a swing and a lightness of foot which always sets me thinking of the slim athletes of Minoan days, Pendlebury would write.
From the port of Heracleion, Pendlebury made his way 3 miles south to Knossos, Evans's spectacular 6-acre restoration of an ancient Minoan city. Inside the great palace, Evans had found marvels of sophisticated design, a plumbing system, chess games, 4-story architecture, locking doors, a trademark registry, a system of weights and measures, and an astronomical calendar. But deep below ground were hints of darker arts, sinister catacombs with mysterious piles of children's bones. Pendlebury got lucky. He found Evans on the porch of the Villa Ariadne, the stone compound that served as his home and a kind of youth hostel and teaching hospital for wandering archaeologists. Students from all over the world were constantly bustling through, enjoying Evans's excellent food and wine, before setting off into the mountains or creeping through the 1,000 interlocking crypts and throne rooms of Knossos. Unlike most scientists, Evans was rich. Between his family's paper mill and his late wife's estate, he had the cash to entertain scholars and bankroll an army of architects, artists, builders, and diggers in pursuit of his hunches. And his wildest notion was this. Maybe Homer's and Virgil's tales about Trojan horses and man-eating cyclopes weren't fairy tales, but historical fiction. Fiction, sure, but still historical. Evans knew he was risking a firestorm of ridicule, but at least he was following in a cocksure set of footsteps. Back when he was getting his start in archaeology, Evans had been spellbound by Heinrich Schliemann, another rich rebel who sought more than proof that heroes existed. He wanted to visit their homes. Schliemann had been fixated by the idea that the Iliad and the Odyssey, despite their magic and monsters, were far too realistic to be just make-believe stories about superhuman warriors and bewitched boat rides. His critics smirked, but that's because, unlike Schliemann, they'd never amassed a fortune after being broke, homeless, and shipwrecked in a foreign country. They weren't living proof, in other words, that average people are capable of epic feats. As a teenager in Germany in the 1830s, Schliemann had hoped to improve his weak lungs by working as a ship hand on a voyage to South America. The boat went down off the Dutch coast, and Schliemann barely made it to shore. Sick and penniless, he slept in an unheated warehouse while running messages by day for a Dutch merchant. By night, he studied so feverishly that by age 22 he'd mastered bookkeeping and 7 languages. By 33, he was boss of his own company and spoke 15 languages. He became such a financial dynamo that during a short trip to San Francisco to recover the body of his dead brother, Schliemann learned about gold prospecting, quickly set up a frontier savings and loan, and pocketed another pile of cash before heading home. But Schliemann's true love was antiquity, and there was something about the Greek classics that always nagged at him. Was Homer really such a creative wizard? Or had his stories lasted so long because they gave off a whiff of the real? Take Agamemnon, King of Men. He sounds too operatic to be true, the way he butts heads with Achilles, blood sacrifices his own daughter, leads an army of warriors in battle for Helen of Troy,
and then comes home victorious, only to be murdered by his wife. But if it's all fantasy, why did Homer crowd his narrative with so many directional details that it reads like a pirate's map to a treasure chest? So Schliemann treated it like a map, and